May it please the Court. My name is Caroline Trapini, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Solomon Monroe, through the Appellate Clinic at Wake Forest University School of Law. At this time, I would like to reduce my rebuttal time to 1 minute in light of the change to a 10-minute argument time. Your Honors, for today's argument, I want to focus solely on Claim 2, that Mr. Monroe was not proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of murder based on accountability. In November 1996, Mr. Monroe was arrested and charged along with Michael Thomas, Tyrone Curry, and Tori Jackson with first-degree murder in the November 23, 1996 death of Keith Stalker. Mr. Monroe was convicted on a theory of accountability and sentenced to 40 years in prison. The main issue before this court is whether or not the appellate court was objectively unreasonable in finding that a rational trier of fact could have found the established elements of murder based on accountability when there was insufficient evidence to meet the essential element of intent.
Now, why couldn't the jury, infer based on the fact that Mr. Monroe struck Mr. Stalker with the 2x4, that he was an intentional and knowing participant in a common plan to commit a battery on Mr. Stalker? And why wouldn't that alone render him responsible for the murder under the Illinois accountability statute? You know, under the Illinois accountability cases, I guess I should say.
Your Honor, the Illinois law states that under a common design principle, where two or more people engage in the criminal design, any acts in furtherance of that committed by one party are expected to be part of the entire group. However, Illinois law also states that two different intentions and two different actions can take place at the scene of a crime, and that's one of...
The culmination of their joint design to basically commit a felony or commit a battery on Mr. Stalker in retaliation for the actions of Mr. Stalker's fellow gang members?
No, Your Honor. It could be argued that Monroe stated in his own testimony in the record that he was angry with Mr. Stalker, and he did strike him twice on the legs with a 2x4, but then he removed himself from the situation and stepped away.
Well, that's his testimony, right?
Well, also, Your Honor, on page 117 of the record, Mr. Jackson, who is the only witness at the scene that testified, stated that he saw the shock on Monroe's face when Thomas pulled the 12-inch knife.
Right, but Jackson didn't have Monroe distanced from the scene, did he?
He did. He did state that Monroe had stepped away, and when he was also stepping away, he saw the shock on his face, noting that...
Did he have him a half block away?
No, Your Honor, he did not.
Is there any difference between accountability in a death case and felony murder?
For the purposes of this argument, no, Your Honor. We're not contending that...
Well, this is a classic felony murder case.
But we're not contending that...
Someone is killed in the course of a crime, and all the participants in the crime are liable, right? I mean, suppose you have two people rob a bank. One is armed, one isn't. The one who's armed kills a teller. Well, the one who wasn't armed, he's guilty of felony murder or accountability. The only difference I can see is that in accountability, it embraces crimes that don't involve a death.
And also at the same time, the cornerstone of the accountability statute is intent. And what we're trying to argue here today is
that... No, that's the whole point. You're accountable even though you didn't intend the specific injury that ensued from the criminal activity.
The Supreme Court of Illinois has stated in the appellate court opinion in
so
our record...
So what's your understanding of accountability?
The accountability statute states that one can be responsible for the crime of another. However, under two options, in that you have the criminal intent of the principal or there's a theory of a common design. And in this case, the state is arguing that Mr. Monroe was part of a common design, and the general principles stated from the cases are correct.
You don't want to equate common design with intent to kill, right? Otherwise, they merge. You
I'm
have
not
to
sure
give a separate meaning to common design.
The courts don't treat common design as if it's the actual intent. In most of the cases, for example, in People v. Curtis, the court stated that in this case two people were shooting two guns out of the same car, and they said that obviously it would be absurd to say a criminal design did not go on here. Also, in the Perez case that was cited, the court recognized that they looked for intent along with the common design. And our main point today is, although you can say from fleeing the scene of the crime, being there when the crime was committed, and not reporting the crime, you can infer that there was a common design, but there's nothing else here that these other cases have, such as advanced knowledge or...
Counsel, let me ask you, I have a little trouble getting to a federal constitutional issue here, because the way you all have set up the argument, it sounds like the Illinois appellate court may have disagreed with some other Illinois appellate court decisions interpreting this statute that applies to some very complex, spontaneous, fluid situations. Here we've kind of, the theory as I understand it is basically we've got this kind of instant, spontaneous group effort to retaliate against the against Stalker because of the theft of the drugs by him and his buddies. If state law has some play in the joints there, and there's some room to argue about whether the Illinois appellate court had it exactly right here, I have trouble seeing how we find a federal constitutional issue as opposed to just an argument that, the Illinois courts may have gotten Illinois law wrong in this one.
We're talking about state law because it's the state law that defines those essential elements that have to be met.
Right,
so
but there's some fluidity to how those elements may be applied when we take the broad language of the accountability statute and apply it to Estrada or Perez or Curtis or Monroe. But why isn't that just, in essence, a question of state law?
It's not, Your Honor, because in this case it was objectively unreasonable for the appellate court to just apply those general principles without looking at the holdings of the Illinois precedent. And that's what we've done, that we can point out here today, that one of the principles that
the Taylor case says proof the defendant was present during the perpetration of the offense, that he maintained a close affiliation with his companions after the commission of the crime, and that he failed to report the crime are all factors that the trier of fact may consider in determining the defendant's legal accountability. Well, that's a good description of this case, isn't it?
The general principle is, Your Honor, and what the
general principle is. That's a good description of this case. That's what happened.
It doesn't include the facts of that case or the facts of this case. In Taylor, the defendant rode in the car with the principal.
No, I'm not saying the facts are identical. I'm saying this statement goes beyond the generalities of the statute, and it says these are all relevant considerations.
They are relevant considerations.
And they're present here.
But not enough. In the Taylor case, they're not enough because in the Taylor case...
What do you want? What's the minimum more besides those
three
things?
Some sort of advanced knowledge or some sort of discussion.
No, but that's not required. They make it clear that's not required, advanced knowledge.
Then the question becomes, why is it present in all of these cases where they state that's the general principle, but when you look at what happened in those cases, there is something there. There's something more there.
Well, now you're going way out on a limb.
Well, then let's look at the facts of the actual cases.
You're saying that if a case arises that has a different fact pattern from any previous case, those fact patterns, rather than the statute or the interpretation of the statute by the courts, determines the limits of the law. We can't have a case that doesn't have facts that are the same as previous cases. That's what you're saying.
I see my time is up,
well,
Your
that's
Honor.
That's what you're saying, right?
May I respond?
Of course.
To
why would I ask if I didn't want you to answer, right? I wish lawyers wouldn't keep saying that. What would they say? May I answer the question? No, I just asked it to embarrass you. I don't want you to answer. Is that what they think?
That's not our position, Your Honor, but I think that the facts in the actual cases illustrate how the principles should be applied. And in this case, there are substantial differences. Monroe had no idea that Stalker was armed. He had no idea of a criminal plan. It was completely separate. He used a 2x4, whereas, Thomas came out of nowhere with a 12-inch hunting knife. These were completely
two
different
situations. Well, he knew Thomas was around, right?
He didn't. Thomas was in a separate gangway. He was not near him when it happened.
We've got the whistle. They're all dealing drugs under Thomas's direction, right?
Yes.
We got the whistle. Everybody knows that they just got ripped off by the others. And it's not reasonable to infer that this was a cooperative effort to retaliate?
Our position is that you're skipping a step in the law, because all of these cases involve, even when the court says you can infer from this situation, if you look at the situation where the court is saying that, the defendants had spoke beforehand and said, let's kill this person, or they've given them a gun and knew. In Estrada, the case that the appellate court continually relies on and differentiates it, that person knew that the principal had a gun. He was driving the principal to the location, and he got out of the car brandishing a tire iron. The court recognized he had a separate intention to intimidate that victim, just like Solomon Monroe had a separate intention here to possibly, you know, just injure him for losing the drugs.
I would think that to make the argument you're making, you would need to show a pretty consistent pattern of state court decisions acquitting or reversing convictions under circumstances very similar to this. And I don't see that.
Mm-hmm. One case is the Estrada opinion, and then the next would be the Perez, which was by the Supreme Court in 2000. And then along those same lines is differentiating specifically from the cases that the state has cited in their brief. And we've done that. People versus Curtis, where they said a common design can be shown in that it was two individuals in the same car shooting two guns. In People versus Reed, which the state also cites for the proposition of a common purpose, in this they said that no advance agreement is required, but in those facts, the defendant overheard the two other people saying, we were going to go rob this man, I have a gun, and then he even stuck his hand in the man's pocket, and then they split the proceeds after. In these situations, the common design was striking and very evident, so it just seems odd to put this in the same situation.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Trapani.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Erin O'Connell on behalf of the respondent warden. The petitioner actually raised three claims in his habeas petition: the sufficiency claim he's advanced here, a Fourth Amendment claim, and an ineffective assistance claim.
Well, let's go into the sufficiency claim for just a minute, because Mr. Thomas wasn't even present when the attack on Mr. Stalker began. And he, of course, as far as we know, was the only one with the knife. And as I understand it, there was no discussion between him and the others before he walked up and stabbed Stalker. So on what basis does the jury hold Mr. Monroe responsible for Mr. Thomas's what looks like a very sudden and fatal increase in the violent nature of the encounter when you've got Monroe hitting him and and walking away.
There is a factual dispute, just to address the last point, as to whether he was walking away. Thomas and the petitioner were on the scene originally for a common purpose, along with two other individuals. They were basically running a drug sale business on the street. And it was actually an affront to that business that motivated petitioner as well as all of the others to attack Stalker. This was a gang-related incident. Thomas and petitioner were both black Keystones. And the attack on Stalker was as a result of actions by members of the Gaylord Nation. Now, the common design only needs to extend as far as the battery. And there's really can be no dispute here that petitioner had an intent to batter the victim, given that he and Curry were the two that initiated the confrontation with him, and then he was one of the first to strike blows. He went and picked up a 2x4 to attack the victim even further. Jackson's testimony at trial was that petitioner moved back about a foot when Thomas arrived on the scene. So he was still actually participating in the beating at the time Thomas appeared. But petitioner didn't need to intend for the victim to die. He didn't need to know that Thomas was going to kill the victim. It only mattered that all of them were acting in concert with a common design to beat the victim. And it was certainly a foreseeable result of that attack on the victim that he did ultimately die. And in terms of this being a consistent application of Illinois law, in our brief we cited an Illinois Supreme Court case called People v. Terry, 460 Northeast 2nd, 746. It's a 1984 case. It's almost indistinguishable from the facts here. There it was also a gang-related incident where there were five gang members that all participated in what's called a violating another gang member. Four of them used, punches and kicks, and then one of them arrived with a knife, and it, again, happened very suddenly that he escalated the violence. But in that case, because of the common design to commit the battery, they were held accountable for the resulting murder. Just to summarize what evidence there was of the common design here, in addition to his participation in the fight, there was his shared motive. And then, of course, added to that is the fact that he also fled the scene in his vehicle with all of the other gang members, including Thomas, after the stabbing. And then he remained with those individuals for the next 24 hours and made no attempt to contact law enforcement. That's also further evidence. It's not the only evidence of a common design here, but that also supported the inference. Unless the court has any questions with respect to the other two claims, we're prepared to rest on our brief with respect to those, and we would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court denying
habeas. Well, I had a question about that. Because the trial judge made an obvious error in finding that Mr. Monroe went with the police voluntarily.
True, and we can see that.
But did anyone ever try to point out the fact that his finding was inconsistent with the stipulated facts?
No, Your Honor, and actually defense counsel invited the error because there was a delay of 6 months between the time of the stipulations and the evidence and the ruling, and the court said, well, I'll hear a brief argument on your motion. Defense counsel's theory was that the police engaged in trickery, and there was no evidence in the record with respect to that, but the court, in ruling on this trickery claim, said, well, no, I find that there wasn't trickery here, and that was the end of it. But the appellate court on review certainly corrected the trial court's error in this respect, and it was actually a completely inconsequential error in that probable cause, the information that supplied probable cause was present at the time they went to the house to apprehend the petitioner. So it was inconsequential that the trial court erred in finding that he was not arrested then, but at the station house, because the same information was there that supplied probable cause, as the trial court found.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Connell and Ms. Trepani, your time expired. If you have something more you'd like to say, we'll give you a minute.
May it please the Court. Thank you. And I'll just distinguish the one case that the state was relying on being People versus Terry. And in that case, the state was citing it for the proposition that battery in itself is enough. And we would just like to point out that in that case, that wasn't all that was there. Again, there was striking evidence of a common plan, being that after the first fight took place, all of the people involved in the fight came together and stated, "We're going to violate Davis. We're going to kill him." And then Ronald Terry, who was the defendant in that case, stated that he knew Myers intended to cut him.
But what the court said was the substantive offense which the group conspired to commit was battery.
Exactly. There was a conspiracy to commit that battery. Well, and here there was not.
Of that here, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And we thank Wake Forest, and of course, Ms. Trepani in particular, for undertaking this pro bono representation.